Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
In a world where very few people embrace their global identity and seek to understand their neighbors, cross-cultural expert Tayo Roxon is on a mission to bridge this divide. Each week, he'll open your mind with insights from some of the global minds in the world. Get ready, take some notes, and learn how to be the best you that you can be.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of As Told by Nomads, and today's guest is Lila Jana. So, the world's wealthiest countries have donated over $2 trillion in foreign aid to the world's poorest people. Yet, despite this, 2.8 billion people worldwide still struggle to survive every day. We need a better solution. In GiveWork, Lila's new book, GiveWork, Reversing Poverty One Job at a Time, social entrepreneur and founder of Samasource and Luxme, Lila contends that giving dignified, steady, fair wage work is the most effective way to eradicate global poverty. Lila is on a mission to eradicate poverty. She dismantles the current thinking on charity and the West view those most in need. She shows how traditional aid is broken and argues that the solution rests in progressive business models, weaving together private, public, and nonprofit sectors. Powered by Jana's own story, GiveWork also puts faces on the people whose lives have been transformed through obtaining steady work and earned incomes. Welcome to the show.
I'm so happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure is mine. Pleasure is mine. I was reading your bio and I was thinking about, your book, and, I've been talking to a few people about the work that you do. And I'm just curious as to when this idea got started. Walk me through when the seed was planted in you that you knew that this was something you wanted to work on.
So my dad and mom grew up in India, and my dad went to Jesuit school for a lot of his life. And I think the Jesuits have a really deep sense of social justice and morality, which he passed on to me. So I grew up with that kind of in the background. And I also knew my parents had grown up in a very poor country. They would tell me all the time about how lucky we were to be born in the U.S. and have all these opportunities that most kids who didn't, draw this like winning ticket in a birth lottery, we got all these chances. And so it didn't really hit home for me until I went and spent time living in a very poor community. I got a scholarship from, of all places, a tobacco company when I was in high school.
Right.
And I felt weird about using big tobacco money for college, so I used it to go and do volunteer work. And it was kind of a whim. I mean, I definitely cared about community service and social justice, but I never expected that I would go and spend 6 months living in a village in Africa. It just kind of happened. I graduated a semester early and then went off to go do this service work. And when I got to Ghana, I was shocked because I had thought that people were poor because they weren't willing to maybe work hard enough or they didn't have the right educational background. And of course, I got there and I was schooled by my students who could name U.S. senators, who were incredibly articulate. They spoke the Queen's English. I taught at a school for blind kids in, one of the poorest countries in the world. And I was shocked at how motivated everyone there was, not only to work, but to learn. And so I realized that we've all internalized a myth about poverty, which is that that people who are living in poverty are somehow not trying hard enough, which is completely just false. So I discovered that. I spent a lot of time living with and talking to people who made less than $2 a day and understanding what their lives were like. And it's really astounding for most of us to imagine how billions of people survive at this income level. It means constant and avoidable suffering that really should no longer have a place in the world in the modern era.
Yeah, no. And I think the point that you're highlighting there is the fact that you believe that a lot of people, especially in the West, have a shallow idea of what poverty truly is. You know, you touched on it there. We both come from former British colonies where, you know, a lot of us speak English. You know, when I first came here to America, a lot of people were surprised by the fact that I spoke English so well. In fact, people ask me, why is your English so good? You know, don't you live in huts? Like, they would make the Lion King noise because they thought that, you know, basically their perception of Africa as a continent was one giant country where people didn't have access to resources. So, that concept of people not understanding that it is very possible to be somewhat educated, have a large youth population, and still be dramatically unemployed. I'm saying all this to say, how do you explain this to the West? How do you explain this to people that, hey, look, education is there. It's just a matter of providing opportunities. How does that concept translate to the West so that they are willing to help?
That's a great question. And I'm so glad you brought up Nigeria, because I think in many ways it's similar to India, where my parents grew up, and also similar to Ghana, where I had done teaching, and to Kenya and Uganda, where I work now with Samasource. And I think the primary, commonalities across all of these post-colonial countries is that they have strong education systems. Colonialism was terrible in many ways, but one of the upsides of the British colonial system was a strong system of English medium schools that have enabled young people in these countries to really be competitive globally as knowledge workers. And it's interesting because when my parents left India in the late 70s, they were told very similar things. I remember my mom told me she arrived in Buffalo in 1978 because my dad had an engineering job there. And people were like, did you grow up with monkeys living in huts? And my mom has a degree in English literature. She can recite like sonnets, from Shakespeare. She's one of the most articulate people I've ever met. And English is of course one of India's official languages, much as it is in Nigeria or Ghana or Kenya or Uganda. So I think that we've internalized this myth about low-income people, and I think it's a patronizing myth. And the myth is that they, at worst deserve it because they're not trying hard enough to not be poor, which again is like patently false. If you spend any time understanding what life is like for someone on under $2 a day, most of them are working full-time jobs and still unable to make ends meet. And the second myth is that that these people need help and handouts, and they need our, they need our good grace before they can do anything for themselves, which is also, I think, equally patronizing and false. Because what most people around the world want is the same thing you and I want. They want a chance to uplift themselves, to earn enough money to cover their family expenses and live a decent life and afford the basic, the basic necessities: clean water, adequate sanitation, okay healthcare. and these things really are entirely possible to deliver to everyone in the world in 2017. Yeah. This is not rocket science.
Now, and we're going to talk about that more. I want to put a pin on this, but this point that you just brought up is the fact that we have more in common than we think. I run a diversity and inclusion company, and sometimes I go into companies to consult, and we were doing this concept on unconscious bias. And a gentleman there, he said he went on a mission trip, and a bias he hadn't dealt with was the fact that he had this air of superiority because he was coming to help, right? And then when he heard, through translators that, hey, I just wanted to send my kid to school, right? I just want them to be able to survive. He just felt so ashamed of himself, because at that moment he suddenly realizes, like, they want the same thing I want. Like, this idea of me coming to just save random unstructured organizations, like, this mom here just wants to send her son to school and be able to provide for the family. And at that moment, I think those humanized moments, you said you went on a trip and you sort of got schooled. those are those type of things that that really show that, I mean, come on. A lot of us want the same things. And given the climate of the world today, we just had the unfortunate incident in Las Vegas and what's been going on with the natural disasters and seeing how that can wipe away a country's resources. My country, Nigeria, and several countries in the world, I think it's important that your book is coming around this time to just sort of remind people that, hey, we as humanity can do much more together. And especially as entrepreneurs, we can provide all these resources there. So I just wanted to say that before we moved on. So another thing that is interesting with your story is how you got started. Because I believe were you working in another company before Sama?
I was a management consultant for a firm called Katzenbach Partners that got acquired by Booz & Company, but basically like a strategy consulting firm in New York.
Absolutely. Now, and I live in New York now, and I definitely know the consulting world and that company. But walk me through the conception of Sama, when you had that idea, and then when you decided to just basically say, you know what, I'm quitting my job and I'm going to do this full time.
So I had the idea for Sama. So I'd been thinking about job creation as a solution to poverty for a while, because I had spent that time in Ghana, and then I decided I would study international development and poverty reduction in college as an undergrad. So worked on that and spent a lot of time talking to poor people. I think one of the things we forget to do when we're, especially in philanthropy and international aid, is to spend time with our customers, and our customers are the people we're trying to help, right? So I tried to spend as much time as I could understanding what life is like for someone living on less than $2 or $3 a day, how they make their decisions about spending, and how they make ends meet. And as I spent more time researching this as an undergrad, and then I worked briefly at the World Bank, I realized that we kind of have it all wrong. We're investing in basically different versions of an aid model that started quite a long time ago and is now not so relevant. And our current era of international aid started after World War II in America's effort to rebuild Europe. And a lot of it was self-interested. It was America's effort also to find markets for American exports. So we sent food aid to Europe, and then that mushroomed into sending food aid to post-colonial, newly independent countries in sub-Saharan Africa and Latin America and Asia. And what dawned on me over my years studying this is how much that model no longer served the poor. Perhaps never really served the poor, to be honest. And so in 2005, I met Tom Friedman. I read The World is Flat, and I thought to myself, maybe digital work could be a really interesting answer. Here's this powerful new trend. Computers and internet infrastructure they're popping up all over the world. And for the first time, it's possible for a bright young person in Nigeria or Ghana who could have access to a computer to theoretically do work for a company around the world. And what's exciting about that is that it frees labor from the constraint of geography. So it no longer means that your fate has to be dictated by where you happen to be born, which is so arbitrary, right? Like, yeah. I could just as easily have been born in a slum in India, in which case I would be living on under $2 a day with zero opportunity. So theoretically, the internet circumvents that and creates this powerful new way for us to connect educated and talented people with decent living wage jobs, even without them moving. Yeah. And that theoretically is an extremely powerful force, arguably the most powerful force in human history, to unlock, I think, the most important natural resource, which is the brain power at the bottom of the pyramid. Yeah. So it dawned on me that this was the case. I was working as a consultant. I knew that I wanted to work on poverty reduction, but I had become so jaded by what I'd seen of the aid world that I didn't want to go into that field. And that's why I had started consulting. I thought maybe I'll learn about business and I'll start a business that could employ lots of low-income people. And I read Tom Friedman's book. I actually met him at a conference. And I was in India consulting for a large outsourcing company when I met a young man who was commuting into the company from Barabi, which is South Asia's largest slum. It's where Slumdog Millionaire was filmed. And the idea that a person could commute to this fancy call center from one of the worst slums in the world, where literally there are like open sewers outside and cholera outbreaks and just horrific conditions, it like blew my mind that that was possible, that that we could see such a dramatic like reversal of fate in the same generation because of digital work. And so I started to learn more about this new industry of outsourcing work, of like third-party companies doing work for Western businesses, right? Often overseas. And what struck me is that this could be a very powerful way to create jobs, not just among middle-class people in India and the Philippines, where most of those jobs go today, but actually to poor people. And I thought if we could break down work into smaller chunks so that we could easily train someone who doesn't have a lot of experience to do the work, then that's the real win. That's how we dramatically impact poverty. And so that idea dawned on me, and I quit my job eventually and started working on Sound the Source full-time. I entered a business plan into a couple of different competitions for social enterprise, and that's how it started.
A few things to unpack there. So you basically took an outsourcing model and you turned it into a social enterprise. Is that correct? That sounds like that's what you did.
That's right.
Wow.
That's right.
Yeah. Oh my goodness.
And I was really inspired. I mean, I think the leader in this category is Muhammad Yunus. I was really inspired by the work he'd done at Grameen Bank, and especially the work that he'd done to take the banking model, which never served the poor, in fact, often preyed upon the poor, and flip it on its head and say, look, you know, if we can give big loans to rich people, why can't we give small loans to people who don't have much money, who also need access to finance? So he totally like smashed a hammer into the traditional way of thinking about finance and banking, which is that it's inefficient to provide small loans to low-income people. Maybe they won't pay it back. And he showed that actually poor women, women living on $2 a day, pay back their loans with more frequency and more reliably than a lot of wealthier people. And I wanted to do with banking, with outsourcing what Muhammad Yunus had done with banking. He converted banking into a microfinance model, and I wanted to convert outsourcing into a micro work model.
Wow! No, that's. I mean, I love all this, these type of stories, because you basically, a lot of times we can just take models that work in other industries, and we can apply that to industries that we feel like need help, and it really, really does work. Now, there are a few things here. You also said, you know, you had a few competitions. You sort of rushed through that, and then you talked about you quit your job. But let's go through that. You quit the job. And I know that you've said in the past that you don't come from a wealthy family, right? And you were paying off student loans, right? So this is not just any drastic. This is not just like any decision that you didn't take some thought into. But you knew that, and you decided, no, I'm still going to do this. It's something I still want to do, and I'm going to do it. The first question there is why, and then the second one is the competition you entered. I think it was in Amsterdam, right? You got the first runner-up prize, and maybe you got $25,000. I think that's what you won. How did those two moments connect to leading you to quit your job?
That's such a great question. It was really tough to decide to do that, and I still sometimes wonder. Should I have worked at like Facebook or something for a couple of years, or tried to work for, for one of these tech firms? But I couldn't help it. And once I stumbled into this idea, I was kind of on a mission, and it was really tough. I had three jobs in college. As you mentioned, I didn't come from a wealthy background. A lot of people assume, I was just interviewed yesterday and someone was like, oh, you have a very, fancy kind of background, going to Harvard. I mean, I can't tell you how not fancy my childhood was. Mm-hmm. We had no money. I worked multiple jobs since I was like 14 to have an allowance. My parents really couldn't afford much. And I had never even visited college campuses before I decided to go to Harvard. I just went because I had the best financial aid package there. So I was hardly like the trust fund kid doing social mission work. And for me, it was really scary because I had no nest egg. Still, my parents, they don't own a home. I've been on my own for a really long time. And I think maybe one of the ways you know what you're meant to do is that you will do it no matter what. Like, you'll do it even in the face of overwhelming odds against you, and often when it's totally irrational and everyone sane around you is telling you that you're kind of crazy. And for me, I think maybe one of the benefits of coming from no money at home is that I always knew that I could work. Like, worst case scenario, I was a I babysat a ton when I was in middle school and made a lot of money running a little babysitting business for the neighborhood. And then I worked as a legal secretary. I worked as a tutor. I worked as an usher at a theater. I mean, I did every job you could imagine. Wow. And that builds resilience because you realize, like, okay, worst case scenario, I can always make money doing one of these other things and I'm not going to be homeless. Yeah. And I also I think having immigrant parents creates a sense of hustle. If your parents had to hustle and your parents also came here with nothing and, you know, I was a first generation American. So,
yeah.
I think it does build resiliency. And I actually think now that's one of the qualities I'm most grateful for. Cause I think it really, it's really necessary if you're launching a company to have that ability to keep going when maybe other people might quit.
Yeah.
Maybe a sane person might quit.
No, you're so right with the immigrant hustle. Cause you know, I mean, I'm not even an immigrant. I came here as an international student. So my options were very limited because I needed one type of visa, primarily an H-1B visa. And then I quit the job after a near-death experience and I decided to move here. And everybody, my parents included, thought I was crazy. Like, we did not send you to America to do all these things. Is this why you're wasting our money? So, you know, they had all those comments to me where they would call me and they would say all these crazy things. But when you said the immigrant mentality, it was something that I just tapped into. I was like, you know what? This is, I just feel like.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Lagos, Nigeria is such a hustle mentality. I feel like you'd be able to make something good out of something if you do what you truly love, no matter what the downs that come with that. And it sounds like you did that as well, because obviously it led you to Amsterdam. You got $25,000. That's hardly enough to start a business, but then you sort of use that to lead you to basically going full-time into Sama.
So I used that. I had that. It was actually a check. I'm looking at it in my office right now. At the time, I called the business Market for Change, and they gave me one of those big checks. I was a runner-up. I wasn't the first prize winner. So that enabled me to quit my job. And then the next thing I did was enter more business plan competitions. And I also placed second at the Stanford Social Enterprise Challenge a few months later in early 2009 and got another, $12,000.
Wow.
And together, I kind of cobbled that together and then launched the company in September of 2008. And that's how, that's kind of how it began. And it was tough. I mean, I remember I was tutoring on the side to make money then and, doing various other Craigslist odd jobs, which was crazy. I'd come from a management consulting background where I had a corporate Amex card and a nice apartment in Manhattan and flew business class and stuff to literally sleeping in this tiny room in Mountain View that I found on Craigslist. And at one point, sleeping on my ex's futon, who remains a good friend and, you know, one of those people in my life who really helped make my business happen. But it was hard in those early days. And I guess what convinced me to keep going and really keep building the Sama Source was this feeling that nobody else was doing it. If I didn't, who would? And that there was just this incredible opportunity with East Africa getting internet infrastructure to grow something, you know, potentially very big that could help millions of people one day. And I so believed in it. And I think the best evidence for an entrepreneur that your business is working is if you can break it down to the unit level. Like in our case, it was by project. I had won a contract. I convinced this entrepreneur in San Francisco who were in Palo Alto who I'd known who had a project that I knew I could potentially win. I convinced him and broke him down over weeks of pleading to give us this deal. And he gave us a $30,000 contract to do data entry. And I won the business because we didn't even at that point have like a facility to do the work in. But I won the business telling him, look, I will personally do all of the quality assurance. I will review every page of these transcripts and you have my word, they'll be perfect. Like, and if they're not perfect, it'll be my fault, not the workers. And so he's like, okay, if you're willing to do that, I'll give you the contract. And then once we had the contract, I had a partner in Nairobi who had an internet cafe. He had a couple computers there. And I convinced him, I was like, look, you know, you hire people to do this work from your internet cafe and I will win the contracts. And that's how we got started. Wow. So he went from 4 computers to like 50 computers the following year, eventually employing hundreds of people at this facility in Nairobi and being our earliest and strongest partner. And eventually we decided to build our own facility in Kenya where we now employ, we have about 1,300 workers in total. We employ 900 in our office in Nairobi, and and the business is now profitable.
That's incredible. That's an incredible story. And we're talking to Lila Jana here. She's the founder of both Sama and Luxme. That's correct, Luxme. Sama Source.
That's
and
right.
Luxme. And Sama. Before we go to Luxme and then the book, Sama is the root word for equality in many languages. Is that correct? How did you even come up with that name?
I've been looking at different names. I really love Sanskrit names. There's something for me that ties to my own personal origin story. My mom is half Belgian and half Indian, and my father's Indian. And I've always felt this connection to the sort of language and arts and spirituality of their homeland. And I love Sanskrit names. And so my own last name means people in Sanskrit, Jana. And I had thought, maybe I'll find a name there. So I started just poking around. I'm a big yogi, and the concept of balance is really interesting to me. Those who are yogis listening to the show know that Sama means balance. So it just is a great word. And as I started testing it with people from other regions, people told me, oh, it means sky in Arabic. In Indonesian, it has a great meaning. It's just a generally sort of positive, good word. In a lot of cultures, easy to say and easy to remember.
Gotcha. All right. Well, let's talk about Luxme and then we'll go into GiveWork. How did you move from Sama Source to Luxme?
So I had been working and growing Sama for about 6 years before I had the idea for Luxme. And basically what I built with Sama Source is what we built with Sama Source. It's now a team and I can't take credit for most of our success. What we built was a really interesting what we call give work model. So our core philosophy is we can best address the problem of poverty by buying things directly and paying living wages, buying things from low-income people. And the best way to help them is not to give them a handout, but to give them work and purchase from them on a level playing field. So that's the core idea, this give work idea. And Sama Source is a B2B company. We sell to large technology enterprises that need data services. So a lot of our work now is doing things like image tagging, image annotation, and various other services for computer vision teams building the next technologies in self-driving cars or smart hardware. But it dawned on me that this give work model could be really powerful for a consumer brand as well. And I kept meeting people who would say, oh, how can I help Sama Source? I don't actually have a data project, but I love what you're doing. Is there any way that we could, like, you know, buy something from Sama Source? And consumers really can't buy anything from Sama Source. And so I thought to myself, you know, this is an interesting opportunity. What if we could build a give work consumer brand? And at around the same time, I stumbled into an incredible ingredient called Nilotica. It's an heirloom variety of shea butter. So it's a separate subspecies, and it only grows wild at the source of the Nile River in East Africa. So it's got different chemical properties than West African shea. It's really a unique ingredient, and it works incredibly well for hydrating skin and as a wrinkle-reducing ingredient. So I started using it myself, and I had heard about it because women in northern Uganda are obsessed with it. They start massaging it on their babies from, like, days old. It's one of the reasons people say that that the women of northern Uganda have such perfect skin. So I started using it, fell in love with it, and thought to myself, wow, this is such a powerful ingredient, why has nobody marketed this as a luxury product before? Because there's really like nothing more luxurious than an ingredient that not only makes you more beautiful, but makes the world more beautiful in the way that it's made. Oh. And that's how it kind of, that's how it started. So I decided to start the company. I gave a third of my personal equity to SomaSource and got the blessing of my board, raised venture capital, and kicked off last year. We launched in every Sephora store as the first fair trade and organic brand at Sephora nationwide. And now I sell it on QVC, at Sephora. We sell it directly on our website at lxmi.com. And it's we've developed a small line of products around this core ingredient. We have a few more launching very soon. But the real idea is to build a new kind of luxury company that's based on beauty for humanity, as opposed to just beauty for ourselves.
Now, this is amazing, and I love the work that you do. And the reason why I love what you do is that you come from such a pure place of just trying to help, because there's this mindset that you have that I share with you on. It's this concept that you don't have to accept the world for what it is. You can mold it into what you think it could be. And the reason why I love what you do is that you are doing that with business. You know, a lot of times people have this idea of business and sort of help and poverty as this things that can't coexist. And you somehow managed to use the power of entrepreneurship to tackle some of the world's problems. So why do you have that mindset? You know, it's very easy for people to be negative. You know, the violence, the inequality, injustice that exists right now, it almost feels insurmountable. But why do you have this relentless amount of hope?
That's such an interesting question. My grandmother was a Belgian woman who in 1948 decided to hitchhike around the world after World War II, starting with $5 with a group of students. And so she decided to do that and went overland for 4 years through Southern Europe, North Africa, the Middle East, met my grandfather in Calcutta in India, and then made it all the way overland back to Paris, again, starting with $5. And the idea that that she could do that at that time and not only emerge unscathed, but actually have this tremendous experience. She wrote a book about it, which I found on French eBay, which I translated. It's a really crazy story, but it's a beautiful story of how we should, as she would always say, trust the world. She always had this like very optimistic sense of what's possible and also of what other people's intentions are. And she would always tell us that as kids that, you know, you can choose to be afraid and see the worst in people, or you can choose to be positive and see the best in people and realize that ultimately people around the world want the same things. So she had this incredible philosophy and I think this gift for connecting people and for being a global citizen. And that was always part of my upbringing. And I think if you feel fundamentally that everyone has roughly the same capabilities and the same desires and the same talents, and then you also see extreme poverty and, again, avoidable suffering, it's really hard to reconcile those two things, right? Like, if we do live in a world where talent is equally distributed, then why is a kid in Ghana dying of malaria at age 5 because her parents can't afford a $5 malaria treatment? Like, that should not ever happen on our watch, right? It's like an entirely preventable and avoidable situation. So the only explanation for that is that we've designed really bad, inadequate systems to cater to the human needs of the worst off people. And I felt this like moral compulsion to do something about it. And once you see that kind of stuff, you can't unsee it. Sometimes I wish I could have a different career that would be like a little bit easier. But once you've been affected by that, it's really hard to ever forget it. And I think for me, it just became this like lifelong mission. So yeah. Now that we've been able to build a company around it and it's less kind of desperate and I have a salary and I'm able to afford a home and not worry about where my next meal is going to come from, it's a little less stressful. And now that I have this perspective, I can't imagine doing anything else. And most of the people who work at SomaSource and Luxme have the same kind of passion and commitment to what they're doing. It really is like a gift to be able to wake up every morning and do something that you feel is totally in line with your deepest values.
No, I love that. I admire that. And I share that mindset. And I think, you know, it's easier to give up. It's easier to give into the idea that we're all doomed. But, it's harder to walk through the wilderness, as Brené Brown would say, and basically say, hey, we're going to be, vulnerable, and we're going to basically share these moments, but we're going to work through this pain in order for us to get to the good stuff. And obviously, all this has worked and culminated in your upcoming book, which is just out, Give Work, Reversing Poverty One Job at a Time. Why now, Lila? I'm sure you've had offers before to write. You said your mom could recite sonnets. You know, you come from a background where, English and just the whole idea of literature is probably something that you've sort of naturally gravitated towards. But why now? Why do you feel like your book needed to come out now?
It was kind of a series of coincidences. I met my agent who had gone to college with us, and she was really lovely. And she's like, look, now's a good time because we just reached profitability at Somasource last year, which really, I think, allows us to tell the story because it can scale a lot bigger now. And I think the other piece of it was I really wanted more people to embrace this concept of giving work. And I feel like we've been pursuing one solution to poverty reduction for a long time that's really not working that well. And the faster we can shift that investment into enterprises that give work and this new category of social business, the faster we can solve these problems. Like I don't want to travel to developing countries or even to parts of America and see people living in avoidable suffering. I want that to be over within my lifetime. And so I feel like there's this urgency to spreading the word. There's also a really unprecedented amount of money being spent by companies, by large corporations on goods and services that for the first time can now be deployed to spending on vendors like Somasource that give work and address poverty at the root in the supply chain. And that's really like one of the most powerful, I think, aspects of the book, as I talk about how the real win is for big companies to spend money on goods and services that that would otherwise go to more traditional vendors and not create a social impact.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's good. And people can find this book on anywhere books are sold, right? Or Amazon, bookshelves everywhere.
That's right. Anywhere books are sold. Give Work. At givework.org, where they can also learn more information about the
givework.org, givework.org, Barnes and Nobles. If Borders is still around, sure it's there. It's on Amazon as well, but we'll put the links in the show notes to givework.org and even the Amazon link. But I've really, really enjoyed talking to you. I know we're getting ready to close. But before I ask sort of the culminating question here is, there's something that happens right now. I explained to you, and you already know this, this recent string of disasters we've had, natural and human-based, human-caused. There's this idea of metrics around help. Like, donate, 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 donate. And a lot of people have this jaded bias against, well, I don't really know what the effects are doing. Where do you come into this? You know, I know you're sort of in both worlds, but you're in social enterprise. How do you measure, track, all these things to make sure that your efforts are effective?
So that's such a good question. And anyone who's curious can look at our impact methodology at Somasource. If you go to somasource.org/impact, we actually produce quarterly impact reports in many different we look at many different indicators, what food people are eating, how their housing situation is changing, what they're investing in. And the best way to track impact, of course, is to do surveys on workers and understand how that money is relating to material changes in their lives. So we track that. We also do these quarterly impact calls, which I think are kind of cool. They're modeled after quarterly earnings calls at companies. So we report out on our impact every quarter with a live video call that anyone can see. We put them on Facebook Live and Google Hangouts, and people can submit questions. And so we really try to be as transparent as possible. And then what's happening in our space, which is really exciting, is we're starting to see third-party auditing now. of impact. So just like nonprofits every year undergo a financial audit to make sure that they're doing what they say they're going to do. And what's now really exciting is that you can do that for social impact as well. So we have a third-party group of development economists that analyze all of our impact data and published a report, which we publish on our website. And I think that is increasingly important. I think every social mission organization should have an impact audit and should publish that audit and use it to learn how to be more effective in whatever their theory of change is. Mm-hmm. The nice thing about SAM is we have a pretty clear metric of success, which is moving people out of poverty. And so it's pretty easy to measure that. We look at the income they made before SAMA, which is on average about $2.20 a day.
Yeah.
And after SAMA, we move them to over $8 a day, and they stay at that income level long after they leave us, which is, of course, really, really helpful. So
Yeah. And you know, nomads and everyone listening right now, it's, you know, the idea of going from $2 to $8 is astronomical. My country, Nigeria, is, you know, has the largest GDP in Africa, but also at the same time, the largest amount of people living in abject poverty. And abject poverty, a lot of times, is described as people that barely make, you know, less than $2 a day. You know, we have, last I checked, it was 86 million people living in abject poverty a day. So you can imagine how going from $2 to $8 can actually affect one. And standard of living is always varied in different parts of the world. So thank you for sharing. This has been an amazing pleasure. I would be remiss if I did not ask you my mission statement. It is the reason I do everything I do, and it's the reason why I feel like I was called here on Earth. And my mission statement is use your difference to make a difference. So, Lila, how do you use your difference to make a difference?
I guess I use my difference to give work, and reverse poverty through the mechanism of the market.
Yeah, yeah. Literally the title of a book, Give Work, Reversing Poverty, One Job at a Time. And she uses a difference to give work. And her businesses also give work. So make sure you check that out. It's been a true pleasure. I will put everything in the show notes. This has been an education in many ways. And I've loved your honesty and you just talking about your entrepreneurship story and the possibilities that we all have within ourselves to inspire change and really tap into the beautiful world that we don't get to celebrate.
It was such a pleasure talking to you, and thanks so much for sharing our story.
Yeah, pleasure's mine. Till next week, ladies and gentlemen, use your difference to make a difference.
You've just been listening to the As Told by Nomads podcast. For more ways to reach out to Tayo and to use your difference to make a difference, head over to www.tayoroxon.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.